I love pumpkins in the fall. Some are short and some are tall. Round and orange, a wonderful.
Oh my goodness, I was laughing at that song. Thank you, Jeff, for finding that lovely pumpkin song. Pumpkins are amazing, too. You know, they go from this little teeny tiny seed to these humongous pumpkins. And today we're going to be talking about that transition. I'm Jill Najoe, and you're listening to WPR News. And our guest today is Shannon Engel. He's a pumpkin grower and expert carver based out of Menominee, Wisconsin. Shannon operates Engel's Great Pumpkins and Carvings with his wife, Jody. Are you a pumpkin grower? What have you learned from your experiences? Why don't you share those with us or give us some questions you want to know about growing your own pumpkins? Our number, 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Hi, Shannon. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you.
Well, we appreciate it. I'm sure your busy time is kind of slowing down now, huh?
Yes. We're finally winding down for the season, so.
It's got to be a little bit of a relief for you.
Yes, but we start planning for next year already.
Okay, like all good businesses, that's what happens. How long have you and your wife been growing pumpkins?
I've been growing pumpkins probably since like 1995 and started being a competitive giant pumpkin grower in the year 2001.
Wow, you were way ahead of the trend then, weren't you?
Yes, I'm a longtime veteran of growing giant pumpkins. So.
What was your, why did you want to do that? I mean, what drew you to growing the giant pumpkins?
I've always grown big pumpkins.
Okay.
And I had already, in my backyard, I had always grown like what I thought were big pumpkins that were somewhere around 125 to 150 pounds that it took two or three people to move. And one day I came in and I saw on TV the Top Field Fair was happening, and they were using skid steers to move their pumpkins. And I said, what am I doing wrong? And had to figure out how they get them that big. And the rest is
history. Yeah, because you've been involved in some of these, well, the largest pumpkin weigh-offs in the world, right? You've helped run a couple of them.
Yes. I am the president of the St. Croix Growers Association, which helps run the Stillwater Harvest Fest in Stillwater, Minnesota on the second weekend in October. That's one of the world's largest weigh-offs with the highest prize payouts. And then I'm also a member of the River Prairie Ginormous Pumpkin Fest.
I love it.
In Wisconsin.
I'm assuming those have already taken place?
Yes.
Okay.
Those have already taken place.
How big were the winners this year?
This year in River Prairie Ginormous Pumpkin Fest, we had a 2,551 pound grown by Jim Ford from Wisconsin. And then in Stillwater, Minnesota, we had one that was 2,357 pounds grown by Caleb Jacobus out of Wisconsin also.
Wow. What makes Wisconsin a good place to grow pumpkins?
It has to do with the 45th parallel. We get the perfect amount of sunlight, and it doesn't get too hot. And I don't know how to explain it any more than that.
Okay. Because don't people in the United Kingdom do pretty good at growing giant pumpkins and giant vegetables also?
Yes. A lot of the big growers will make their climates perfect by growing them in greenhouses. We start our pumpkins off normally, we normally start our seeds on tax day, April 15th, and we will typically have our pumpkins in the ground by the beginning of May.
Go ahead. Yep, I was just going to say, and what do you do to keep them safe from frost?
Oh, we have them in baby hoop houses, which are small miniature greenhouses.
Mm-hmm.
We have soil heating cables. We have lights. We have heaters going on out there. We throw everything at them that we can to possibly give them an advantage so the pumpkins are to their max, almost to the size of the growing area by probably about the middle of July.
Wow. So how many pumpkins how many plants do you grow every year?
We grow four plants, and each plant gets 625 square feet of growing area, which is 25 by 25. There are some of the larger growers will give them up to 1,000 square feet. So.
Wow, that's amazing. Now, is there an actual market for those giant ones, or is this just like a competition thing?
It's a competition thing, but once the pumpkins are done at the weigh-offs, a lot of times they'll be sold to go on display somewhere.
Okay.
So, because one of our pumpkins will end up at Lambeau Field, and the other pumpkin will end up at the Mall of America.
Oh, wow. That's wonderful. So people probably have seen your pumpkins already. They've been to either place. Yeah. Well, then what happens to them after that? What, all those seeds inside, do you collect those and do you sell them, or you just keep them for yourself?
The seeds, the pumpkins are collected by the growers, and they're a lot of them are turned back into the growing clubs. And then we turn around and we sell those seeds to make our prize monies for our prize structure.
Oh, well, that makes sense. I was wondering where all the money came from. So that's a good way of doing it. So we probably have some pumpkin growers listening. What kind of tips do you have for growing just regular pumpkins?
For regular pumpkins, staying up with your weeding and giving them plenty of space and keeping an eye out for bugs and other diseases.
What are some of the ones that hit? I mean, I had some gourds growing this year, and I got mildew on them. Is that pretty common?
Yep, powdery mildew is very common. We typically start spraying a fungicide in the middle of July to prevent powdery mildew from happening. Once you get powdery mildew, it's yours to keep for the rest of the season. So you want to prevent it in the first place.
Well, that makes a whole lot of sense. Now, you've got this plant and you're going to have lots of blossoms and you're going to have babies starting. How do you decide for the giant pumpkins which one you're going to keep?
Typically, we train a plant in a specific pattern, and there's a main vine and there's secondary vines that run perpendicular to the main vine.
Mm-hmm.
Want to set a pumpkin on the main vine if possible, and we want to set that somewhere between 15 and 20 feet out on the main vine. And you pollinate everything on the main vine, and then eventually you make the decision and you're all in on it.
And so you've got basically four pumpkins then that you're working with?
Yes.
Okay. And what was the biggest one you've ever grown?
The biggest one I've ever gotten to the scale is 1,454 pounds. I'm known throughout the world for my big, beautiful, and orange pumpkins. There's something out there called the Howard Dill Award. That's the prize I'm going for.
Okay, so the ones that we see a lot of, the huge ones, are kind of yellowish and not exactly pretty.
It's not a beauty contest. It is a weight contest. A lot of the growers out there will tell you their favorite color is heavy.
I love it. So for those of us who do want to grow pumpkins, now I've thrown pumpkins out in my compost pile, and the next year I've had some really good pumpkins. And then when I've planted them and taken care of them, I get nothing. So what's the key to getting pumpkins to grow? Do we need special kind of soil or watering techniques? What do you suggest?
I would suggest if for pumpkins, anytime you're going to plant pumpkins, pumpkins are heavy feeders. I always recommend lots of compost. Leaf compost is better than animal manure compost. You can overdo animal manure compost and throw your nutrient ratios off. And also making sure you have plenty of sun and plenty of water.
Okay, so do you have a certain amount that they need per week? How do you figure that?
Basically, the pumpkin plants require an inch of water a week.
Okay.
And that's about, I believe that's like 722 gallons per each plant. So our plants are set up on there's a timer, and it basically I'm throwing 200 gallons of water on that plant a night.
Wow, that's a lot of water, but that's a lot of pumpkin.
When the pumpkins are growing during their peak growth period, when the pumpkins themselves are growing, they'll put on anywhere from 25 to 50 pounds of weight gain a night.
Oh, my gosh. So What about how do you know how big they are going to be weight wise? Just by looking at them, you know by now.
You don't have a pumpkin app on your phone?
Darn it, this one I don't have.
there's a pumpkin estimator app out there, and we measure them. Basically, we measure the volume of the pumpkin. We enter that information into the app, and it gives us an estimated weight.
Oh, that's really neat. Who knew? But I'm sure you're happy that that's out there. It must be easier for you than when it was back in 2001 when you started, right?
Yeah, we had a paper sheet, and you would have to look up on the paper sheet to see what it is. And now you just enter the numbers. So
I love it. Our guest is Shannon Engel. He's a pumpkin grower and expert carver based out of Menominee, Wisconsin. Shannon operates Engel's Great Pumpkins and Carvings with his wife, Jody. What question do you have about growing pumpkins, either small ones or giant ones? Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. Shannon, do you have to worry about giving too much water too fast? Will they burst open?
You want to keep the water consistent. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, if you let it go into a dry period and then we get a nice warm rain in August, the pumpkins will literally gain too much and they'll split wide open.
Okay. And that would be a disaster, wouldn't it?
Yeah. Once there's a split or damage to the pumpkin where it breaches the cavity, that pumpkin is no longer eligible for the way up itself.
Okay. Well, that makes sense. So if we've got someone out there saying, you know what, I've got a pretty big space to grow stuff, maybe I'll try to grow a giant pumpkin, where do they start?
I would look up on Facebook or on the internet for the Wisconsin Giant Pumpkin Growers or the St. Croix Growers Association or the Chippewa Valley Giant Pumpkin Growers.
Okay.
Get in contact with them. If I was a brand new grower and I want to start, if you contact the Chippewa Valley Growers, I find you a mentor.
Oh.
Someone that can answer your questions and make sure that you get to the scale that year.
Oh, that's great. I love that. So much support.
Yeah.
So how do you, now you've got this giant pumpkin, and how do you get it out of your garden?
There's a special harness that has 8 straps on it that lays over top of the pumpkin. It almost looks like an octopus.
Uh-huh.
And it cinches up around the bottom of the pumpkin, and we use a skid steer to put it on the trailer.
Okay. And then carefully haul it down the road?
They handle pretty well going down the road.
It's
one of the things to do is have a big giant pumpkin on the back of the trailer and see the reactions of people coming up to you and try not being a cause of an accident.
Oh, yeah, I suppose. A lot of gawkers, for sure.
A lot of gawkers. And somewhere along the line, the official sign for that's a nice pumpkin is a thumbs up. So,
well, good to know. We've got a call from Barbara in Grand Marsh. Go ahead, Barbara. What's your question?
My son lives in Wakanda, and he just loves his gardening, and he loves his pumpkins. But the scourge is the squirrels come and start to eat on them. How do you keep the squirrels away?
To keep the squirrels away, the best thing to do is for squirrels and deer is A, fencing, and B, providing them with a food source that they like more than the pumpkins itself.
That makes total sense. What do they, are they tempted with?
Oh, They love beans and peas and stuff like that. And a lot of times our giant pumpkins are covered up with sheets so that the deer don't get to see them or chew on them.
Yeah, that makes sense too. Thank you for that question, Barbara. If you've got any, please give us a call, 800-642-1234. How can you tell when a pumpkin has reached its full size? You know, I mean, not the giant ones, obviously, but just your, you know, everyday smaller ones.
When you're like your field pumpkins and your jack-o'-lantern pumpkins, mm-hmm. You can tell basically the stem will harden up and the pumpkin, a field pumpkin will go from green to a solid orange. And once they turn solid orange, they're typically done growing and they just need to mature.
Okay. So when you say mature, they just sit out there until you're ready for them?
Correct. Okay. If you pick them, if you if you pick a green pumpkin too soon, or you pick a pumpkin that's not at its maturity level, that pumpkin won't last as long.
Oh, so. Okay. Well, that's good to know. What about the seeds of the pumpkin? Do you eat them? Number one, I mean, I'm assuming the giant ones you don't, but with the regular ones, do you harvest those?
With the regular ones, typically we at one time we did harvest those, but right now we go through almost 100 pumpkins a year. Typically, our seeds will end up in a bucket somewhere, and every once in a while, someone will come by and ask us if they can have the seeds, and it's like, go for it, take it.
Sure, understandable. But the big ones you keep?
Yes, the big ones we keep, and we send back out to the growers associations, and we also give them out to new growers.
Okay. Sherry emailed us. She said she was kayaking along the shore of Lake Winnebago, and she spotted ripe pumpkins along the shore. She guesses it makes sense that these are wild pumpkins, like wild berries, but she's never seen them, and it was a great surprise. Have you heard about pumpkins growing wild?
Pumpkins, if given the right choices, they'll grow anywhere that they can get their roots in and get enough sunlight. So I've seen them grow in some pretty amazing places.
Yeah, hence my compost pile. So,
yeah.
I love that. How do you buy a good pumpkin?
How do you buy a good pumpkin?
Yeah, how do you pick one out?
Depends on what you're, like if you're carving a jack-o'-lantern,
mm-hmm.
I pick the pumpkin up, I thump it on the bottom, and I listen to make sure it's a solid pumpkin and that you don't hear any sloshing. You also have to have what your pattern in mind is going to be placed on there.
Mm-hmm.
So, because we do a lot of intricate carvings that are more advanced than your jack-o'-lantern eyes, mouth, and nose type carvings. So.
Sure. But we still like the eyes, nose, and mouth carvings, especially for the little kids, right?
Yeah.
Yes. It's a good entry point. Now this year, we haven't had a problem, but in years past, we will have a frost before the Halloween time. What's the best way to store a pumpkin?
Once the pumpkin is mature and the stem is hard, we bring them into the garage.
Okay.
So that they don't get the frost or freeze on them.
Mm-hmm.
And then keep them in a cool, dry area. We'll also store, a lot of times we'll pull in like a dozen pumpkins and we'll place them in the cold, dry area of our basement. And those pumpkins will stay up until end of May or the beginning of May if we hold them correctly.
Oh my gosh. So do you eat your pumpkins? Do you grow that type of pumpkin mm-hmm. also?
I like squash. If we're gonna make a pumpkin pie,
mm-hmm.
I actually make it out of a winter squash instead of a field pumpkin. I think it has a better texture and it has more flavor and a deeper, darker, richer color.
Oh, really? I'm sure a lot of people are shocked by that. Although when we get canned pumpkin, isn't a lot of that just, it's a regular squash, not necessarily pumpkin?
Correct. A lot of times when you buy a canned pumpkin, it's a different variety of pumpkin that is, it almost looks like a butternut squash.
Okay.
It's larger and bigger,
mm-hmm.
and that's what they make the canned pumpkin out of.
Okay. So it's basically the spices then when we're cooking with either pumpkin or squash. Obviously, a squash is a pumpkin, but pumpkin yep. is a squash, right?
Yep.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, it's the spices, and it's like I said, the winter squash will give you have a more natural, sweeter flavor,
mm-hmm.
where a jack-o'-lantern has a lot of water in it.
Okay.
So it's the winter squash almost has a denser, drier flesh with more flavor.
Okay. Do you have any specific kinds of squashes that you like? You just said a winter squash.
There's one out there called a red yukiri or something. It's like that. It looks like it's a solid orange red squash.
Uh-huh.
It's got a perfect flavor to it. Hubbard's also my next favorite.
Mm-hmm.
So there's some out there called the Black Futso, which is a Japanese hybrid pumpkin, and that is really, really flavorful.
Where would someone find something like that?
at a farmer's market. You're not going to find these kind of pumpkins at your normal grocery store.
Okay. Do you sell directly from your farm, or do you do farmer's markets also?
We only grow the giant pumpkins for competition and do the pumpkin carvings. At one time, we raised 5 acres of commercial pumpkins and squash, and that got too much.
Oh, sure. Is this a full-time thing for you, or is it part-time?
It is part-time.
Oh, okay.
It's my hobby.
Well, it's a fun hobby for sure. What do you love about growing pumpkins?
I'm not sure. I get asked that question a lot. Pumpkins bring smiles to everyone's faces. Mm-hmm. There's some people that don't like pumpkins. I don't understand those people. But other people, from adults to young children to everyone else, when we're at the Mall of America or Lambeau Field, people always see the giant pumpkins. A, they can't believe that they're real because they've never seen anything like that before.
Mm-hmm.
And they're always ecstatic about them. It always brings smiles to people's faces. So.
Do people, when they start, you know, like I was saying earlier, you know, they're going to think, oh, I'm going to grow one. Do they kind of get hooked and get a little obsessed by it?
When I give, every spring I do 2 or 3 grower seminars.
Uh-huh.
The first thing I will say is that giant pumpkin growing is an addictive, obsessive hobby. Anything beyond this point, you're doing on your own will. I have a lot of people that my name is a 4-letter name in their house because the giant pumpkins in the summertime can take up to 2 hours of your time each day. With 4 plants, I spend 2 hours out there playing in my pumpkin patch.
But your wife is going along with this, obviously.
Yeah, she tolerates that part.
Okay. All right. Well, we've been talking with Shannon Engler. He is a pumpkin grower and expert carver based out of Menominee, Wisconsin. And he operates Engel's Great Pumpkins and Carvings with his wife, Jody. Shannon, thank you so much for spending some of your time today with us. We appreciate that.
Yep. Thank you very much.
Okay. Have a good day. Stay with us because we've got more pumpkin information coming up for you. We're talking to a pumpkin artist who's participated in some national television shows. So we'll be right back after this.
A wonderful fruit. Let me share my pumpkin knowledge with you.
Now listen, folks. Here's the deal with pumpkins.
Pumpkin face.
Okay, another classic. Thank you, Jeff. You know, nothing welcomes trick-or-treaters like a grinning pumpkin or maybe a scowling one on your front stoop. We're going to be talking about how to create some amazing ones. I'm Joan Ledeau on WPR News, and our guest right now is Carly Ide. She's an illustrator, a pumpkin and tattoo artist based out of Appleton. Stay with us because at noon, we're going to talk about the science of learning a new language. But first, tell us about your efforts at pumpkin carving. What questions do you have? Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Carly, thank you so much for being with us today.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Okay, I think we got rid of that echo. Is that better?
I hope so.
Okay, I think we're good. Okay, that was me. We had to do this in a rush, so sorry about that, everyone. It sounded kind of spooky, kind of like Halloween, right?
Oh, yeah. It was set up like that. It was totally intentional.
It was totally intentional. Thank you. So what do you love about pumpkin carving? What a really cool niche artistic thing to do.
Well, the beauty of Halloween is it's such a special time, and it only happens once a year. So I've always been pretty artistic, doing lots of different things in the community and kind of different artistic experiences. And it's just an amazing experience to kind of submerge yourself in the Halloween culture and to keep creating and to work with such an interesting medium.
Yeah, they don't teach pumpkin carving in art school, do they?
No.
So I had mentioned earlier, you were a contestant on season 3 of Outrageous Pumpkins on the Food Network. For those who aren't familiar with it, what's the show all about?
So the show is, yep, on Food Network, and it's just a big contest, kind of reality contest show where they bring a bunch of extremely talented pumpkin carvers, and a lot of the carvers do carving year-round. A lot of them have other jobs year-round, but when the Halloween season comes around, it's time to carve pumpkins. So it's just these, it's a lot of contestants that have been on the show before. This new season is the All-Star season, so we're all returning contestants. So it's the best of the best creating these giant sculptures and structures and just these large installations of art made of completely pumpkin and edible, like, produce materials.
That is so cool. Is that running right now?
It actually, the finale was this past Sunday, so just a few days ago.
Oh.
So I won't do any spoilers. if you missed it on Food Network, don't worry. You can stream it on HBO Max or Discovery Plus, or I think you can also get it on Prime as well.
Okay. Well, I'll have to look for that because that sounds like fun. What was it like learning how to carve on a pumpkin? I mean, it's like you said, it's not a material you're used to using.
Yeah, it's cold and it's gross and it's messy. And I mean, the thing is you can't really put it down and then come back to it 2 days later because it's already started rotting. Once you finish a pumpkin, I don't know if you've ever carved a jack-o'-lantern, but it starts getting shriveled up, you know, within
sure.
the next few days. So so it's something that you gotta do on the spot. I learned mostly off of watching shows like mine. You watch shows like Outrageous Pumpkins or Halloween Wars, but also there's so many kind of video lessons on YouTube and online. And a lot of the artists that I work with also do seminars or do classes that will teach you as well. A big part of getting started is just having the right tools.
That was my next question. What are those tools?
The tools can vary immensely. A lot of it is things you can just find in a kitchen, you know, so a paring knife or a butcher knife or even like a mandolin where you can cut the pieces really thin. Then you can go on to more intense wood carving tools. So a lot of people will use the scoops that you use to carve spoons or I know that when I started, the big ones that really kind of changed the way I carved were sculpture tools that you would use to sculpt clay. They're just kind of reinforced, so they're a little bit stronger. And we call them loop tools or ribbon tools.
Mm-hmm.
And those are extremely helpful to just take a little bit away at a time to be able to get that kind of 3D effect.
Is that one of the mistakes that amateurs make, is that their tools are so big that they just take big chunks out?
Well, I suppose the biggest mistake an amateur can make is accidentally, you know, chopping your finger off. So
yes, that would be a mistake.
but no, I think I mean the big thing for me is as a kid I never liked knives. I enjoy cooking, but I don't like chopping. It just wasn't really comfortable, and to make art solely with a knife always seemed really dangerous, especially for children.
Mm-hmm.
I'm still surprised today that people are giving knives to kids to create these jack-o'-lanterns. So it was a huge relief for me knowing that there were other options that I believe are a lot less dangerous and a little bit more clean, in my opinion. I rarely gut my pumpkins. Just gutting the pumpkins would solely be so it's easier to carry around. But sometimes if you carve it out, the squirrels are more likely to eat it. So I usually just leave all the guts in there.
Well, and then if you do that, that's probably why they don't last quite as long. Is that right? Then
I guess it varies. I leave the guts in there, but I'm not sure. I guess with more airflow, you get more chance of bacteria getting on the inside of the pumpkin. So I would almost think gutting it would make it rot faster. But
mm-hmm.
I'm not sure. I never really tested it. It might be a good experiment.
There you go. Yeah. Well, you certainly have a lot of pumpkins around right now. So, what about those tools that you can get in the grocery stores or whatever? They're probably under $10. Are those worth buying?
I love them. You'll notice if sometimes watching the show that we'll use those tools too, just because they're specifically made for it.
Mm-hmm.
But they aren't going to be helpful to the style that I do, just because I do kind of a 3D relief sculpture work into the skin of the pumpkin,
mm-hmm.
while those are more for your cut-throughs and jack-o'-lanterns. But I think those are a perfectly fine thing to buy, mm-hmm. especially if you've got a starting artist in your family. It's just always a great thing to support any sort of art that they get their hands on. If they do want to try something a little bit different, you can get most of the tools that I use off Amazon. It's not an extremely expensive hobby unless you are carving those big Atlantic giants. I mean, those 1,000-pound pumpkins will cost you over $1,000. So that's a whole nother animal.
Have you ever done one of those? We were just talking about giant pumpkins on the first half hour.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've done three. One in the first season of Outrageous Pumpkins, I made it to the finale, so I got to carve a 1,500-pound pumpkin. And then I got to carve another one this season. And then actually a few weeks ago, I went to Rockford, Illinois, and I was visiting some of my other carving friends, and we all got together and carved another Atlantic giant that was over 1,800 pounds. So, it's a really amazing experience because they've got really thick skin and they're super fun to work with, but a ton of work.
So obviously you've got your pumpkin, you need to create something. You have a fairly short timeline to come up with an idea and then execute it? Or do you maybe during the winter start saying, this will make a great pumpkin carving, so I'm going to write that down and do some sketches? How do you work?
I tend to be kind of a last-minute person. I don't mean to generalize, but as a woman, I do like to plan ahead. But when it comes to creativity, that's my space. It's my special time. So those aren't things that I like to, that I dwell too much on ahead of time. If you get hit by the creative bug, you got to do it right away or you're going to lose it. And I think a lot of creatives will agree that when you hit this, when you get inspired by something, you got to do it right away. So, when it comes to pumpkins, it's usually an on-the-spot decision. I rarely plan things out. Unless it was the show, then we really had to plan things out. But, yeah.
So what do you carve on your pumpkins? What are some of your favorites?
I personally like just scary faces, lots of teeth, but I also love animals. It's one of my favorite things, so I'll always, I'm really good at cats, or I carve like a bulldog or a pug face, something like that. Those are great faces because their heads are already shaped like pumpkins anyway, so it works out. But yeah, pretty much any animal. I'm thinking this year before Halloween, I might carve a hippopotamus in front of the house, since there's a cute little hippo on social media that's really, really popular these days. So you just kind of go with the trends, but I mean, sometimes you'll just see a pumpkin. You're like, oh, this looks just like this. I have to carve this out of it. You kind of let the medium do the talking.
Yeah, that makes total sense. So do you carve all the way around the pumpkin or just the front? Or how do you do that?
Yeah, it depends on where the pumpkin's going to go. If it's a place that is going to stay pretty stagnant and that people are only going to see the front, you might as well just carve the front. Don't waste your time unless you have a goal to make it all the way around the pumpkin. So you kind of got to think, where is this pumpkin going to sit? But also, what's the design? Is it going to Is it going to be good for an all-around piece? I did a carving of, it was like a rat that was like digging into the pumpkin. Sometimes you'll get a pumpkin that has a big rotten spot in it. You can't really help it. There are definitely some tips and tricks to figure out, you know, if the pumpkin you're picking is the right one or if it's going to be rotten, but sometimes you'll still get a little rotten spot. So I carved a rat kind of clawing into it, but then you have the tail like wrapping all around and things like that. So yeah, it just depends on your design, and you certainly can go all around the pumpkin. There's no one stopping you.
There are no pumpkin police to worry about.
No, I hope not.
So how do you pick out a quality pumpkin?
Well, first you got to think, like, what style do I want to do? So if you want to just do a jack-o'-lantern, any pumpkin that you usually will get that has a nice, smooth, buttery, like, orange outside, you want to pick it up. You know, if it's pretty lightweight, that's good for a jack-o'-lantern because, you know, the skin is pretty thin. You want a nice, smooth outside. Just if you're looking for something like that, just kind of focus on what looks good to you and what you want to show in your home. If you are looking to do something like what I do, where it's more 3D sculpture work, you want to kind of pick the pumpkin up. If it feels heavier than it looks, it might be a good one. You also want to make sure that the skin is soft. You don't want to go, some pumpkins have darker skin or like textured skin, and sometimes those can be really hard to cut into. You might need power tools. Also, take a look at the stem. If it's got a really cool twirly stem, that's a really great thing for a decoration at your house. But also, if the stem is yellow or if the stem feels soft, there's a good chance that there might be moisture inside the pumpkin and that there might be a little bit of rot in there. You want to feel around if there's any soft spots. You want to make sure the bottom doesn't have any soft spots, things like that. Actually, on the show, Titus and I, we ended up picking out some rotten pumpkins, which was too bad.
Oh, what a shame. We're talking to Carly Ide. She's an illustrator, a pumpkin and tattoo artist, and she's based in Appleton. We'd love to hear from you if you've got any questions for her. Did you see her on the Food Network? What'd you think? Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or you can send an email, and that's talk@wpr.org. And this is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Najoe. Stay with us because at noon we're going to be talking about the science of learning a new language, and it doesn't matter your age. But right now we're talking about pumpkin carving. Do you have any questions? Do you have any ways that you like to carve your pumpkin? Give us a call, 800-642-1234. Or like I said, you can always send an email, and that's talk@wpr.org. So have you in the past, put your light inside of a pumpkin, so carved it out and whatnot. When you do your, I know I've seen a lot of carvings where they take that light into consideration, but you don't do pumpkins like that?
It really depends. And the great thing is during the Halloween season, it's all about things looking creepy and scary and kind of ugly. So I don't ever shy away from any instances. And people ask me all the time, do you make mistakes when you're carving pumpkins? Yes, absolutely. All the time. But that's the beauty of Halloween. And sometimes you'll end up with a hole straight through your pumpkin and you're like, well, I guess it's a jack-o'-lantern now. So just got to think on your feet. It's always a good idea to put those lights in the pumpkins, especially if you're inviting trick-or-treaters over. You know, you want them to know that it's a safe space. I love a jack-o'-lantern. And on the show, they do emphasize placement of lights quite often as well. So it's all a big part of it. I don't usually stray too far away from tradition.
So when you do that, now we've traditionally always carved the top open, you know, and then put the light inside. But lately I've been noticing that people are opening in the bottom and then putting them over a light. Have you tried that?
Yeah, we have done that. I think that's a great option. It makes it a little bit easier. You can kind of dictate a little bit more what, where the light is. Also, it might end up being a little less dangerous depending on what kind of light you're putting inside. I suppose if you really were going to try the tradition and put an actual candle in there, it might be more dangerous if it's sitting on the base of the pumpkin. You know, you don't want anything to start on fire, but I'm not quite sure what the how that works. But I think the only reason I wouldn't do that is the worry that any of like the pumpkin kind of moisture would get onto, you know, the concrete. And I'm not actually quite sure how easy that is to get off your front stoop. So, but it I guess it really depends on your aesthetic. If you want that nice round bottom, maybe just put it in through the top. Some people will put the light in through the mouth too, if you make the mouth big enough. Also, a lot of carvers will put the light in through the back as well. So it's really your aesthetic. And I've also seen, it's really cool actually, where someone will carve into their pumpkin in the front, but they will do no cut-throughs. They'll only carve lightly through the skin so that it just takes away a little bit of the skin so you can see the image, but it's not completely cut through. But then they'll put a fully cut-through image in the back, and then they'll put the light in the center. That way the light will project the image that you carved in through the back on the wall behind the pumpkin. I hope that makes sense. It's hard to kind of explain it. But there's really a lot of tricks that you can do with lighting, mm-hmm. And you can have an effect from the front, but have the light show through the back. It's kind of neat. I'm constantly inspired just seeing kind of just normal people do cool carvings online.
Yeah, it is amazing, and people just really go all out. For those who've never carved but have, you know, done the traditional triangle eyes and what have you, what is the first step? Do you actually peel the pumpkin before you carve it?
Yeah, so the first thing we'll do is take, we have multiple tools. You can use like a produce peeler. You can also use a rasp. It's something that, or a SureForm. It's something that you use for drywall. There's a few different tools you can use, but first we take the skin off, okay, just to give us a nice clean canvas. Mm-hmm. And then from there, we just slowly kind of build out the planes of the face and the depth and things like that. But yeah, you always kind of want to start by taking that skin off. And also you can do that in a very mindful way, in case maybe the shape of the face is a big part of your carve. Last year I did Jack Nicholson from The Shining, when he's like poking through the door frame, mm-hmm, saying, "Here's Johnny." But then the way I took away the skin on the face was just in the shape of that kind of hole in the door. That way I knew that the face would only go through in this area, but it'll still kind of have that breaking effect on the outside. So even just the shape that you take the skin away will be helpful for your piece of artwork.
What about the, you know, they've got like stencils and things like that that you can use. What are your thoughts on those?
Stencils are great. Honestly, I can't even think of a single way to carve your pumpkin that I wouldn't support, just because I love Halloween and I just love to see people get creative and do fun Halloween things. And you will be hard pressed to find anyone in the pumpkin carving community that is a gatekeeper. We all just want to see people get creative and have fun. So you talk to any of us on Outrageous Pumpkins, and we're just really excited to see people creating and getting inspired by what we're doing. There's no shame in the stencil game for sure. A lot of people will put the stencil over and they'll kind of like poke through with a pencil just so that they have the stencil kind of imprinted on the pumpkin, and then they can take the stencil away. But another option, and which is really funny because it goes along with my full-time job, I'm actually a tattoo artist full-time. But another option a lot of people from home are doing is they're buying tattoo stencil paper, and they're putting their stencil on that, and then they're imprinting the stencil on the pumpkin that way, which is a really, really helpful option as well, and it tends to work for a lot of people. So stencils are a great option.
Tell us a little bit more about Outrageous Pumpkins, the show. What was it like on the set?
Well, the first time I was on the set, I was completely out of my league. I just felt really overwhelmed because I had only been a sculptor, but the show is very much about building structures and creating these large statues of pumpkins. So I kind of had to learn everything all at once during that first season. But in this new season, we're on teams. So they put me on a team with a guy named Titus, who is really, really well versed in building, and he's an amazing structure builder and just very clever on how he puts things together. And so we really made an awesome team where I could kind of do the creative carving aspect, and he was able to kind of build it and put it together and add just an amazing like humor to everything that we did. But all the teams this year are perfectly put together. This may not be fun for some people, but there was no fighting. There was this just not the community we're in. It's just not a lot of drama. It's pumpkins. We understand it's going to rot in a few weeks. So we just want to make the best thing we can make and have people love it as much as we do. So it was a great show to be a part of.
What was your favorite pumpkin? Yours or someone else's?
Well, I know I there's a million of the other ones that I really, really like. But for Titus and I, we put together, it was the Battling Beasts episode, which is, I think, episode 3 in this new season. And we made this bulldog where it was like the face of a bulldog and the body of a bull, and it was like kind of bucking, and then it was being attacked by a horse fly, so it was like half horse half fly. It was we really had fun this season. It was just constant laughing, and I love Halloween, I love horror movies, but when it comes to my artwork and things, I like to go more funny. And Titus, who has children, he didn't want to scare his kids too much watching the show. So we really worked together to create these masterpieces without making them too scary. And it tickled us the whole time. We were just having the time of our life.
So were there prizes involved with the competition?
Yes. So the winners receive $50,000 so that they split between the team. And then they also receive the coveted pumpkin carving belt, which has become kind of an inside joke, but at the same time, like, it's not ironically coveted by us. We always make fun of it a little bit, but at the same time, everybody wants their hands on that belt.
So, sure.
So it looks like a big wrestling belt. It's hilarious, but
it's
not going to help anyone hold up their pants.
No. Well, that's not the point.
No.
So is it sort of similar like other like competition shows where someone gets eliminated every week?
Yes. Exactly. Okay. So this season it started with 7 teams, and then so people just kept getting knocked off. And then by the time the finale rolled around, there were 4 teams
left. Okay. Okay. Sounds great.
So there's plenty of art to look at on all the episodes.
Well, Carly, this has been so much fun. We really appreciate you sharing this, and hopefully people go find the Outrageous Pumpkins and watch it. Thank you.
I hope so. Yeah, thanks.
Our guest has been Carly Ide. She's an illustrator, pumpkin, and tattoo artist based out of Appleton. Stay with us because at noon, we're going to be talking about learning a new language. So stay with us. If you have a question about that, give us a call, 800-642-1234.
Shapes all over the place. It's Halloween, it's Halloween, and we made so much happen on a pumpkin fest.
This is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Najel. Today we're talking about learning a new language at any age. With us are Alejandro Cotonat. He is one of our guests and the co-founder and president of Vamos Academy International. Vamos has an office in Milwaukee where they offer Spanish lessons. They also arrange immersive learning trips to Spanish-speaking countries. Also with us is Pamela Terrell. She's a professor in the Department of Communication Sciences and Disorders at UW Stevens Point. She's also a certified speech language pathologist. What questions do you have about speech and language disorders? Have you tried to learn a new language? What was your experience like? Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. Pam, Alex, thank you so much for being with us today.
Our pleasure.
Yes, thank you.
Alex, let's start with you. Tell us a little bit about your business.
Of course. So we are a language school that provides immersion experience. So we try to help adults mainly that are interested in learning the language for various reasons. And we help them navigate the process. Sometimes we advise them to travel abroad for a more in-depth cultural experience. And that's what we do. We help them with their planning their agenda abroad, choosing the city. We have an actual school in Spain, so many of our students decide to move abroad for some time and take a deep dive, immerse themselves, learn the culture. And ultimately, that's how we go about teaching Spanish. We try people to immerse themselves. That's our approach.
And what inspired you to start that business?
Yes. So back in 2009, so I was born in Spain, and my wife is from Canada. And back in 2009, we've met on a travel, and she had difficulty speaking Spanish. So we figured after seeing some schools and not being very happy with the process, we said to each other, why don't we? Since we love travel and tourism, it was a very natural process. We said to ourselves, why don't we start a school where we can meet a lot of great people and hopefully doing something that we like. And that's in a nutshell how it started.
Is she a French speaker or English speaker Canadian?
Yes, she's an English speaking
Canadian. Okay, so that makes it a little easier for her too.
Oh, for sure.
what is the benefit of knowing another language?
Wow. Well, that's an interesting question. It really depends from what approach we look at it. I mean, many of our students are actually, people that either are living in Milwaukee and thinking, you know, I just want to move to a place with more sun, and I'm a nomad, and I want to work from that place. And they discover that if they do learn the language, they have much more opportunities, not just from a professional stand, but also from a personal, because as you travel abroad to a place like Spain, and if you can learn the language, even if it's at a intermediate level, these people discover that they get to make friends, they get to explore and experience the whole being abroad in a much more profound way. So I guess, you know, from a personal point of view, learning the language enables you to meet more people and to explore. And also, I guess, from this is my personal experience from speaking Spanish and English and other languages, it really keeps your brain alive, if you know what I mean. When you are learning a new language, you will discover that you start thinking in multiple language. You start your whole, and I'm not an expert in this matter, but from a neurological point of view, you really see an improvement in memory and a change in the way we think. So I guess, as I said, there are different angles to why learn a new language. All of them very exciting.
Certainly. Now, Pam, you've been shaking your head about this, and you're definitely coming from the more scientific end of it. What can you contribute to that?
Well, I think Alejandro is totally correct. And we know that as we learn language, when we're first exposed to language, every human in the world is born with the ability to distinguish between every speech sound.
Oh, and I think we're...
About 6 months of age, we lose that ability. And that sounds like a bad thing. And there are parts of it. That's why if you're a non-native speaker, you will always sound a little bit different than a native speaker. They lose that ability at about 6 months is we're only hearing our language that we're being raised in, and our brain is pruning itself to optimize to learn that language. This is why it's much harder for an adult to learn a sentence, because our brain is...
You're cutting out just a little bit there, Pam. I'm not quite sure why.
Yes, is this better?
Yeah, let's keep trying that and see.
Okay, sorry about that. So the fact that our brain is...
Okay, we lost her.
But it's not gone completely. Children, their brains are more flexible and adaptable, so they can...
Okay, Pam, we've lost you a number of times, so let's try to connect with you for on the phone. And Alex, let's go to you to talk a little bit about some of the strategies for an adult to learn a new language when they're out of that critical period like Pam was talking about.
Certainly.
Yeah, what are some of the ways to do that? We talked a little bit about immersion, but what else can we do?
So, well, there's, look, first of all, I want to clarify something a lot of people wonder. Is there a limit? And no, there's no limit of age, meaning we have students that are either just finishing high school or just finishing university or in their 80s. And so I think when it comes to learning a new language, it's surprising how... one would think, you know, I am too old. I probably not going to be able to do this. But that's not true. We've seen it across the board. People of all ages can get to learn a language. And when you've mentioned about the approach or the technique, I do have something very important that I want to share with your audience. I notice a lot of people are going to these new apps, many of which uses AI. And the truth of the matter is, and this is such a great platform for me to share this important message. AI, it's good at some extent, but what we've seen across the board is when you learn with a human being, with a teacher that has emotions and experiences and knows different cultures, you truly learn because you have a person who with whom you can share experiences and talk about different cities and different things. And so in the end, you connect at a human level. And that connection, you could be better at grammar or worse, but in the end, after a few weeks, a month, if you're a more serious learner, maybe even, you know, 3, 4, 5 months, but what we've seen is no matter the difficulties in the student, their difficulties, whether they're to study or to do grammar, no matter the difficulties, when you learn with a human being, at the end of an X amount of time, you will learn. Either you will become more fluent or whether you will become better at grammar. It's true, some people have more difficulties with one or the other. But when you learn with a person, guarantee if you put the time, you're patient, and you give yourself the opportunity, because some people will terminate too soon or too fast, you will learn a new language.
Okay. Pam, I think we have you back on the phone.
Yes.
Oh, great. Thank you so much for being flexible about that. We did kind of miss a little bit about what you were saying. So if you could kind of go over that a little, that would be really nice.
All right. I will be very brief. I was just talking about how what Alejandro was saying about learning language as an adult. As a child, we can perceive every sound in every language up until about 6 months of age. At 6 months, we lose that ability because our brain starts to prune and focus on the sounds of our own language. And this is why a non-native speaker of a language will never sound quite as good as a native speaker, because we lose that ability to distinguish some of the subtleties and the way sounds are produced. But that happens over our lifetime, and so children can learn a second language much, much better than adults can, because their brains are still in that very flexible plastic process.
So we should have give ourselves a little grace if we're older and trying to learn a language. It's not going to come super fast like it does for kids.
Absolutely.
Okay, wonderful. Well, Pam, tell us about your job as a speech-language pathologist.
So as a speech-language pathologist, it's a bulky-sounding name, kind of clunky, but we work with a lot of different things. Most people think of speech-language pathologists as working with children who stutter or can't say sounds correctly. And certainly that's part of what we do. But so much more. We focus on language skills. So that's the idea of developing concepts and words and grammar and being able to express things in written language and spoken language. We also work with cognition, so memory, planning, executive functioning, those kinds of skills, as well as with swallowing. And we work from cradle to grave, all ages, all types of developmental or acquired disorders, and from, you know, adults to high schoolers to infants across the board.
So what's the difference between like a speech disorder and a language disorder?
I explain it to my students. That is a great question. I'm glad you asked. So I explain it to my students that speech is a vehicle for language. We have several vehicles for language. Writing would be another output. Speech is output from our mouth. And then sign language is output from our hands. The language part is what happens in your brain. It's, for example, if I say the word dog, you probably pull up a picture of a dog and you think about what makes a dog a dog. It can bark, it has fur, it has four legs, it has a tail, it's man's best friend, whatever. And so language is what we're thinking. It's the concepts and ideas, and then the way we put them together using the rules of whatever language we're speaking. And the rules are things like how we pluralize, what order we put words in, all those kinds of things.
Okay, well, that's definitely helpful, because I guess I've never thought about the difference between that. So if you had, to someone who like is going to see you, can you help them learn a new language?
That's really not quite in our scope of practice. We would refer them more to an ESL, English as a second language, teacher, but we can support them in that. We do work with people sometimes if they want to work on modifying their accent or learning some of the subtleties of language, things like how we do verb tenses differently in English than maybe other languages and things like that. But we consider that dialect is not a disorder. We embrace dialect and that people sound different from different parts of the same country or from a different country. So the language piece would be more our colleagues in the ESL world. Okay. That are teachers and educators.
All right. Thank you. We've been talking with Pam Terrell. She is a professor and speech language pathologist at UW Stevens Point. And Alex Cottenot, he is a co-founder and president of Vamoose Academy International. Call 800-642-1234 with your questions or your experiences learning a new language. We'd love to hear from you. Or send us an email, too. That's talk@wpr.org. You're listening to The Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. Just a reminder, if you miss part of our show or you want to hear it again, you can always go to our archives at wpr.org/Larry, and you can hear recordings of our broadcasts that go way back. So it's always kind of fun to poke around in there. But right now we're talking about language, learning a new language, and we're going to get back to Alex here. What do you tell a person that comes to you? How do you know what the best way to teach that language to that particular person is?
Well, I guess the first step is to understand why they want to learn the language. I think it's a very important question. Why do they want to learn Spanish? What are their goals and their objectives? Excuse me. Ultimately, after we've learned about that, well, there's a team of people, the academic directors and the teachers who would get involved, and we will all try to participate into finding and creating a plan for that particular person. Some people are more comfortable learning in a group. Some people are more comfortable learning privately with their own teacher. So I guess it's understanding their needs, doing a level test, understanding if they have ever learned Spanish in the past or if they haven't. If they haven't, they will be an absolute beginner, and we will try to create these, let's call it the balance between grammar and conversation. But as I said before, it's exciting when people get the chance to travel abroad and try to immerse themselves. That's the most effective way.
Okay. Pam, have you ever experienced learning a second language?
I have experienced it. I have not been successful in doing so yet. But yes, I took French in high school, and then I have studied Spanish as well. I know enough to be dangerous, and I can understand more than I can speak. I'm certainly not fluent.
Have you found that to be the case with a lot of people, Alex, that they can understand better than they can speak it?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. A lot of people, I guess nowadays, thanks to internet and Netflix, a lot of people are, they've learned. They either have a friend or they watch TV in Spanish. But ultimately, it's a lot of people, it's funny. A lot of people think they know. But when it comes to start and having a conversation, they realize they still have a lot to learn. Mm-hmm. But it's great. No matter their situation and or their level, I personally think learning a new language should be a fun thing to do. Shouldn't be something complex or painful. It should be fun, and it should be relaxed, and it should be done following and respecting the rhythm of each individual, because that's the best way.
Sure, that makes sense. Pam, you might have covered this earlier when we were having the technical problems, but how does a child learn, you know, speech and language? And are there like milestones that they reach in that development?
Yes, and they will learn, just like Alejandro was saying, they're going to start with understanding more than they speak as well. That's how we all learn. That whole first year of life, they're soaking in language, because the first word doesn't typically emerge until around 1 year of age is the average for that. And then around 18 months to 2 years, we expect them to start putting two words together. And then beyond that, at that two-year stage, that's when we have a language explosion. They're learning several new words a week, and then they're starting to learn some of the finessing of language, like how to pluralize words or mark verb tenses and things like that. And then through the rest of our lives, we never stop learning language. We have a finite set of speech sounds, and we learn those and perfect those. But we're constantly using more complicated grammar. We're, especially if we're reading and taking advantage of, you know, lifelong learning, we're constantly learning new vocabulary. There are constantly new words being invented. We have to keep up with how language is dynamic and it's always changing. So we do have certain milestones, and that's what we use to determine when a child would need intervention, is if one of the reasons would be that they're not meeting those milestones.
Okay. Now, Alex, how did you learn English? Was that in school, or did you learn that later on?
No, that was in school. That's a great question, because as a matter of fact, what we've learned at school is very limited. In really, my experience is in many Spanish-speaking countries, the high school education for languages only goes so far. So when I met my wife, she at the time didn't speak any Spanish, and my English was not very good. So I decided, yeah, it was a very interesting yet fun experience, because we both wanted to communicate very into a complex state of communication, and we were unable. So we both took a deep dive into learning each other's language. We, I think, successfully achieved it. We loved it so much that, I mean, we decided to start teaching ourselves. Well, not ourselves directly, because we're not personally qualified, but we started the school, which grew a lot in Spain, in Argentina, in Milwaukee, and other cities too.
So you have pupils, students in Argentina and Spain that are learning English.
Both English and Spanish.
Okay. Okay. Well, that's interesting.
That's right.
Yeah. So do you get to travel between the countries
a lot?
Okay.
As a matter of fact, I just came back from Malaga in Spain, which, by the way, whoever has the opportunity to travel to Spain, highly recommended city, 300 days of sun, beautiful place.
You know, I just read an article on it, and I've heard that it's one of the hidden gems of Spain. So, yeah, that's great. So how can you, as a parent or a grandparent, help your children learn another language? I don't know if that's in your wheelhouse, Pam, but either one of you want to answer, go right ahead.
Yes, learn another language beyond the...
Yeah, or just learn language in general.
Well, for learning language in general, the way we learn language developmentally is by, you know, having people speak to us initially and then that back and forth of response. So when young children start to develop language, they're going to use a lot of syllables. And so they'll babble, they'll do da, 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 and that has no meaning. They're just playing with their mouth, and it has no meaning, but we go, oh, you said da, da, and they're like, well, wait, when I did that thing, this person's face got real smiley, and they seemed excited, so I'm going to do that again. And over time, we shape that. And it actually becomes meaningful that that's dada, and we point when they're doing that, and we make those connections. So talking and then responding to the child as well. And then even as we think about second language learning, it's the same way. And we, in fact, when we have clients who are bilingual, we encourage the parents to speak the heritage language in the home. We do not want to lose that language. And usually the parents are going to be more confident in their first language and can convey things that they may not be able to convey in English. And so we really want to hold on and nurture those heritage languages. A lot of times families think that they need to give up that language or speak English in the home, and we would discourage that.
Mm-hmm. What about you, Alex?
Well, that's a great question. Actually, Pamela, maybe her explanation is much more complex and forensics than what I'm going to say next, but I do have a young toddler. She's 4 years old, and, my wife and myself, wanted to make sure that she would be fluent in both languages. And so what we have decided is that we were going to choose days and times in which we would only speak Spanish or we would only speak English. And we have been doing that since she was very young. And fortunately, doing that and exposing her to different cultures, and I don't know how scientific this is, but it has worked very well, because now she's able to both 4 years old. She can speak English. She can speak Spanish. And she can, you know, she's a basic level, but she can write her in both languages. And we have achieved this by, as Pamela said it, as I primarily focus in speaking Spanish to her and in my wife, her name is Ingrid, focus in speaking English. And then we had this agenda in which days it's only English or only Spanish. It seems to have worked.
So has your child corrected you in your English and your wife in her Spanish yet?
You know what? I notice it's getting there. She's four, and I think she's getting into that point. And I have to say, you know, I like it because she's a very strong individual, and I love to see her growing and learning. But I think it's so interesting from the neurological point of view, the fact that these individuals are being born bilingual. They have more tools to communicate and to express themselves, and that is fascinating. I don't know the science of it, but it's mm-hmm. definitely fascinating.
So, Pam, is Alejandro and his wife doing a good thing, the way they've been teaching their child?
Absolutely. That is the ways we recommend are exactly what they're doing, either picking times of day or certain activities. Like at dinner, we speak in this language. When we're on the playground, we speak in this language. Or having one parent speak their native language and the other parent speak their native language. So that's absolutely the way children learn. And an interesting thing about as they're learning language, it kind of all levels off at around five with both languages is where it really kind of clicks. But for example, we expect an 18-month-old to have about a 50-word expressive vocabulary. And sometimes the parents will be concerned because they'll think they're language delayed if they're learning two languages, because they'll say they only have 12 Spanish words, but they have 40 words in English. Well, if you add those together, that's over 50 words, so they're right on track. What they will often do is they will use the word that is easier to pronounce. So they will switch back and forth between the two languages in one, you know, sentence. You may have half Spanish words, half English words, because they're smart and they're figuring out the patterns, and they're even putting words in the correct slots. I had a friend who's a Spanish teacher, and she was raising her daughter's bilingual, and I remember her toddlers asking for, like, more agua. And so they were, you know, combining English and Spanish together and in the right English order to do that. And so that's exactly, you know, how children do learn two languages.
So what happens then when these kids go to school?
They are usually pretty fluent in both languages.
Okay.
and probably ahead of most of us. I really wish that I had been raised bilingual, because, again, as I said earlier, it's much easier to learn two languages as a child than as an adult.
Well, if anybody has any comments or questions about learning a second language, we'd love to hear from you. Phones have been a little quiet here today. 920-285-1986. That's 800. I forgot the telephone number. 642-1234. So anyway, if you've got any comments about that, please give us a call. Actually, you mentioned, Alex, about Netflix. Is it reasonable to watch a movie with subtitles to pick up a language?
You know what? There's so many studies, and they all show that it works. So it's a natural process. You cannot force it. But if, again, adult children, it doesn't matter. If you could be patient, because it's frustrating not understanding at first. And so one, I think patience is crucial, and be open-minded. Mm-hmm. And so let's say you have your favorite show, whichever is that your favorite show. If you could give yourself the opportunity to listen to your show in Spanish with English subtitles, if you prefer, or even in English, but with Spanish subtitles. In any case, after some time, what we've seen is that those people will pick up at a subconscious level sometimes, but they will pick up many aspects of the language, which at first may be unknown to the person, but eventually will become more evident that it does help, that it helps with the learning process. It helps to pick up on words. It helps a lot. And maybe I'm not the most qualified person to explain the neurological part of it or the technical and how the mind works, but if you could give the opportunity to yourself and try, I promise the audience it works. Give it a try.
Pam, have you had any experience with that?
Yes, and I think, again, that's absolutely right, that just the exposure, because that's how we learn language anyway. So seeing it and or hearing it again and again, language is pattern-based. And that's what our brain does. As children are learning, whether it's their language or a second language, to learn language in general, our brain is constantly running statistics. And we start to have predictions about which sounds go together in words, word order, and different things that we do to words that we speak. So the more you're exposed to it, your brain is going to start. We love to find patterns and things. And our brain is going to start, without us even thinking about it, to recognize those patterns that are happening, whether they're in the subtitles of how things are written or whether it's spoken language.
Okay, thank you. We've got Jonah from Little Chute on the line with a comment. Go ahead, Jonah.
Hi there. Thanks for having me on your show.
Sure.
I can only speak English fluently, but a couple of years ago, I wanted to learn French because my grandma on my mom's side emigrated from France to the United States as an adult. So I had a bilingual person in my life, but really that was it. There's no other, like, French is not the most useful language where I live. But I tried learning it anyway, since I have a personal connection. And I had a really hard time because it was a Latin alphabet, you know, letters that were mostly shared with the English language. And I was just having a hard time and, like, getting them confused. So instead, I was like, what if I picked a language that has an entirely different alphabet so that I'm not getting the two confused? So I chose to learn Arabic a couple years ago, and I'm still very rough. But that actually really helped, starting fresh, a different alphabet. So if any English-only speakers are having a hard time, just try an entirely different non-Latin language. You might find that that works for you.
Well, thank you, Jonah. Pam, do you have any comments on that?
It kind of blows my mind, actually, because when I learn a second language, having some exposure to primarily French and Spanish, a little bit to Portuguese, I very much rely on the alphabet to help me produce sounds. I think it would be more difficult to learn a language like Arabic has a Cyrillic alphabet, or languages like a lot of Asian languages that are more pictograph based. That sounds much more difficult, but you know, if it worked for him, that's awesome.
Yeah, that's great that for those people who do have a problem, maybe everybody's brain works a little differently, right?
Yeah, for sure.
Alex, have you noticed, ever tried to learn a language like, you know, Japanese or Russian or Arabic?
Well, Pamela says something very interesting, and I'm going to quote her. It blows my mind, too, because sincerely, I have looked into it. I've always wanted to learn a third language for many reasons. It's just exciting, and it really helps with your neuroplasticity. But when I've started looking into Chinese, for an example, that is more cryptographic, it's more figures, really, I gave up. It was so tough. I traveled. I went to Hong Kong. I tried, and sincerely, it's very difficult. So this gentleman, wow, he's at a different level.
All right. Way to go, Jonah. Jen in Madison, go right ahead.
Hi, thanks. I have a question about my grandson. He is attending a French immersion daycare. His parents both speak English as their native language, but my daughter also speaks Spanish fluently. And I'm wondering how they can put all that together somehow and get him so that he's speaking all three. They don't speak any French, but he's getting that every day. So I'm just curious if there's a way to somehow end up when he's five that he can also speak French and Spanish and English.
Well, now's the time to do it, right, Pam?
Right. Yeah. I used to live in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and there was a multilingual preschool there. And I remember giving an articulation evaluation to a five-year-old who was exposed to three different languages in her school immersion program throughout the day. And I will never forget, I'm flipping the easel with little pictures for her to say the words, and she kept switching between all three languages the whole time. So again, I think that the children will kind of default. For example, if you have a word like shoes, I'm trying to pick a few things that I know in Spanish. So zapatos in Spanish, correct me if I'm wrong, Alejandro. But that's multisyllabic versus shoes in English, which is one syllable. So the child, if they know both languages, would probably go to the easier one to say. It will be interesting. I suspect your grandchild's vocabulary, that there will be words known more related to the daycare environment that she learns in French, and words that are more home-based words like furniture and things like that, that she'll probably know in English. And I think it'll just be interesting to see, and then, you know, with some Spanish thrown in there as well, to see how her brain sorts it out. The trick will be if she continues being exposed to French past that daycare age, because if she's not speaking it regularly, she will start to lose that ability. It's going to have to be continually spoken and maintained. But yes, our brains are capable of learning multiple languages at the same time.
Okay. Well, good luck to your grandson, Jen. Thank you for the call. Susan emailed us. She said that she learned French in high school. Probably 30 years later, she took conversational Spanish, and a few years following, she boned up on French for a trip to Brittany. She found in the process that when learning Spanish, French words intruded on her. And then when reviewing French later, the Spanish words intruded. She said it's a really interesting business. Alex, have you had that happen with you?
I've seen it. I've seen it in people, yes. It's how the brain works. And there's personally, I think it's all about how often you're practicing the language. So if she's sporadically traveling to France or to a Spanish-speaking country and she hasn't gotten much practice, that is the effect. You're going to start mixing the different words from the missing languages. There's one thing that really helps, and I wish I could have given that advice to other people before, but I'm Mr. Immersion. So if you could travel, if you have the opportunity, and do it, and do it often. So every time you go to either it's Paris or Quebec or Argentina or Spain, it's an investment.
Okay. We are talking about language today, learning a second one at any age. Pam Terrell is a professor and speech-language pathologist at UW-Stevens Point. And our other guest is Alex Cotenot. He is co-founder and president of Moose Academy International. We'd love to hear from you about your experiences learning a language. Our number, 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You're listening to The Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. Tomorrow on the show, we're going to talk about what you can find in the dark in nature. We're going to be talking to the author of the book Night Magic. And we'll also talk about jumping worms. That's starting at 11 tomorrow right here. But right now we're talking about language. And we have an email from Tom in Fox Point. He's taking a Spanish class with a local recreation program weekly. And he also uses Babbel and Duolingo. Is there any particular way that he should use them to enhance what he learned in the classroom? Alex, you have students that are using those apps as well as taking courses from you?
Certainly. Many of them are using those apps. And as I said in the beginning of the show, I personally think those apps can be very useful up to some extent. I think that for those who are taking the first steps into the language, it's a great tool. But ultimately, nothing can replace an actual teacher, a human being and the human connection. No matter how much AI or how much technology is used, I personally think after 15 years of being in this industry, learning with a teacher, it's mostly the best way to go. And if I may, some people may think that it's actually very expensive. The truth of the matter is, it's not. There are many schools, whether ours or any others, where there are very affordable and accessible tuition fees. Doesn't have to be expensive.
Mm-hmm. That's a good point. Pam, have you worked with things like apps in your line of work?
Yes, and I'm glad you asked that question because I was wanting to chime in about apps with young children as well. There are many, many apps geared towards children learning language or early concepts like colors and numbers and letters and things like that. And again, children always learn better through human interaction. Another thing to consider about those apps is many of the educational apps that are designed for children. If you go into the About or the Creators, you learn that they are computer experts who learn how to create apps that children want to continue to play, and they are not learning and developmental and speech language development types of people. So they're often created by people whose background is more in computer science than in the ways that young children learn. Not all apps are bad, but generally we use them sparingly and cautiously in most speech language therapy, except for with people who are unable to speak, and that is called augmentative and alternative communication, or AAC for short. There are dedicated devices for that, but there are some helpful apps that help people communicate with an iPad, for example, if they cannot speak. Okay. So that would be an exception.
Great. Thank you. Christina in Reedstown has a comment. Go right ahead, Christina.
Hi. I grew up, my mother was Norwegian, and we spoke Norwegian at home, and she always spoke Norwegian at home, and we traveled to Norway quite often in the summer. I'm 56. My children, I spoke Norwegian to them, but they have an American father, which I did as well. But the thing is that I always made them, when they were little, listen to Norwegian books on tape, watch Norwegian. Yeah, I had videos and stuff. And even though, like, in their teenage years, they didn't want to do it and stuff, now when they're in their 20s, they definitely speak really well. And I think it was that early exposure, just hearing the sounds, all the music and stuff like that. I think that's really beneficial.
Okay. Alex, you are agreeing?
Well, absolutely. Actually, I think that's the way. That's the way. And as I said before, that early exposure, it's crucial. My daughter, she's 4 years old. And I was very diligent with my wife to make sure we both would speak Spanish and English and make sure that that she has as much exposure as possible, whether it's by videos or communicating in the language or traveling abroad to Norway. Either way, this is the way. I personally think that's how it's going to be more successful and effective.
Pam, is music a good tool for learning another language that that you've heard of?
Yes. Music is great for helping learn language just in general. If you think of a lot of children's songs like Wheels on the Bus, for example, it's very repetitive. They have hand motions. So if you don't have the language yet, you can do the hand motions until the language develops. And we tend to process and remember music and melody in a different kind of way. So that's what we can think of, tunes of songs, maybe not always the words that go with them, but that music can be a really rich way. And I would suspect that the caller's adult children have very fond memories of those songs. And it also embeds, because music is different from culture to culture, so you get some of those music elements from the culture, and then even with the videos and the stories, there are different, you know, folk tales and fables that are culturally significant as well. So I think that's just wonderful.
Great. Thank you, Christina. Elizabeth in Platteville, go ahead.
I was taking a German class because I wanted to learn to speak it. I had to learn to read it for scientific purposes. But there was a man in the class who was in his 70s, and he was going back to Germany to visit his relatives. He wanted to be able to talk to them, and he had forgotten his German. He spoke German till he was 5 years old, but he had lost it because he quit speaking it. We were about halfway through the semester, and all of a sudden, it came back to him, and he got very excited, and so did the teacher, and they were talking to each other in German with their eyes shining, and everybody in the class was looking at them in wonder. So it was exciting to me, too, that his vocabulary of the five-year-old came back.
That's amazing. Thank you for sharing that, Elizabeth. Pam, what's going on in the brain when that happens?
Well, I wish I knew. The brain is very complex and fascinating, and there's so much we don't understand about it. But I will say that the language generally is not lost. It's in there. It just kind of, you know, it's like an old attic with some dusty cobwebs, and it's not being used. So I would suspect over time hearing the rhythm and intonation of German, being exposed to those words, that it kind of clicked. And we also know that, you know, people on the other end of things, they might have something like a stroke and be able to speak a second language that they've never spoken before. How does that happen? We don't know. And that's very rare, but it's not unheard of. So the brain is very complex, but I love that. And I totally can understand that, yes, what he was exposed to just with the right priming, that he was able to remember that.
That's great. Thank you again, Elizabeth. John in Manitowoc, why don't you go ahead?
Hi. I have a couple comments. My experience with language learning is both personal and professional. My personal experience was I studied Russian in high school for 4 years, and found it very, very difficult to learn the language. I took a course in college, and it ultimately gave up and just said, I can't learn this way. It's not working for me. Then I joined the Peace Corps a few years later, and they taught language in a completely different way. They taught key phrases, key grammar, by using it as opposed to explaining the grammar. And they had us live in an immersion setting. And for 10 weeks, we were immersed and bombarded with language, at the end of which we were supposed to have enough language skills to be able to essentially survive in a non-English speaking environment. And it worked for me.
Just like you were saying, Alex, right?
Well, that's right. This is what we have seen consistently. As we immerse ourselves into the language, I think there's a key here, and it's the need. When I mentioned before, when we ask the students, what are their goals or objectives to learn the language? In this case, he had to learn the language. He was immersed. He was in an atmosphere where the need of understanding what was being said was of utmost importance. And so the brain works in very interesting ways. When you have the need, it will happen. It will come to you.
And maybe if you put that GPS into Russian, John, we'll see if you know where to go, if it'll all come back. Well, I want to thank you both for being with us. It's been very enlightening, and you've given me and encouraged me to keep learning my French, which isn't going really well, but I appreciate that so much. So thank you both.
My pleasure.
We've been speaking.
Thank you.
You're welcome. We've been speaking with Pam Terrell. She's a professor and speech language pathologist. Why can't I say that? At UW Stevens Point. And Alex Cantonaud. He is a co-founder and president of FAMUS Academy Internationale. Thanks for joining us. We'll be back again tomorrow, and we're going to be talking about night magic. Thanks.